pretend that my practicals would have any such compunction. Well, Severard?
Any such a what?
Glockter gave a sad smile. You see, he doesn't even know what one is. He sagged back in his chair, tired, terribly tired. He seemed to lack even the energy to lift his hands. I have already made all manner of allowances for you. Treason is not normally so gently dealt with. You should have seen the beating that Frost gave to your friend Worms, and we all know that he was the junior partner in this. He was shitting blood throughout his last few miserable hours. No one has laid a finger on you yet. I have allowed you to keep your clothes, your dignity, your humanity. You have one chance to sign your confession and to answer my questions. One chance to comply utterly and completely. That is the full measure of my conscience. Glockter leaned forwards and stabbed at the table with his finger. One chance. Then we strip you and start cutting. Magister Ida seemed to cave in all at once. Her shoulders slumped, her head fell, her lip quivered.
Ask your questions, she croaked.
A broken woman. Many congratulations, Superior Glockter. But questions must have answers. Worms told us who was to be paid and how much. Certain guards, certain officials of his father's administration. Himself, of course, a tidy sum. One name was strangely absent from the list. Your own. You and you alone asked for nothing. The very queen of merchants, passing on a certain sale? My mind boggles. What did they offer you? Why did you betray your king and country?
Why? Echoed Severard.
Fucking answer him!
Screamed Vitari. Ida cringed away.
The Union should never have been here in the first place, she blurted. Greed is all it was. Greed, plain and simple. The Spices were here before the war, when the Goska was free. They made fortunes, all of them. But they had to pay taxes to the natives, and how they chafed at that. How much better, they thought, if we owned the city ourselves, if we could make our own rules. How much richer we could be. When the chance came, they leapt on it, and my husband was at the front of the queue.
And so the Spicers came to rule Dagoska. I am waiting for your reasons, Magister Ida.
It was a shambles. The merchants had no interest in running a city and no skill at doing it. The Union administrators, Worms and his like, were the scrapings from the barrel, men who were only interested in lining their own pockets. We could have worked with the natives, but we chose to exploit them, and when they spoke out against us, we called for the Inquisition. And you beat them and tortured them and hung their leaders in the squares of the upper city, and soon they despised us as much as they had the Gurkish. 7 years we have been here, and we have done nothing but evil. It has been an orgy of corruption and brutality and waste.
That much is true. I have seen it for myself.
And the irony is, we did not even turn a profit. Even at the start, we made less than before the war. The cost of maintaining the walls, of paying for the mercenaries, without the help of the natives, it was crippling. Ida began to laugh, a desperate, sobbing laughter. The guild is nearly bankrupt, and they brought it on themselves, the idiots. Greed, plain and simple.
And then the Gurkish approached you.
Ida nodded, her lank hair swaying. I have many contacts in Gurkle, merchants with whom I have dealt over the years. They told me that Uthman's first word as emperor was a solemn oath to take Dagoskar, to erase the stain his father had brought upon his nation, that he would never rest until his oath was fulfilled. They told me there were already Gurkish spies within the city, that they knew our weakness. They told me there might be a way to prevent the carnage if the Goska could be delivered to them without a fight.
Then why did you delay? You had control of Koska and his mercenaries before Kadia's people were armed, before the defenses were strengthened, before I even arrived. You could have seized the city if you had wanted. Why did you need that dolt Worms?
Carlot Dan Ida's eyes were fixed on the floor. As long as Union soldiers held the citadel and the city gates, taking them would have meant bloodshed. Worms could give me the city without a fight. My entire purpose, believe it or not, the purpose you have so ably frustrated, was to avoid killing.
I do believe it, but that means nothing now.
Go on. I knew that Worms could be bought. His father has not long to live, and the post is not hereditary. The son might only have this last chance to profit from his father's position. We fixed a price. We set about the preparations. Then Davoust found out.
He meant to inform the Archlector.
Ida gave a sharp laugh. He had not your commitment to the cause. He wanted what everyone else wanted, money, and more than I could raise. I told the Gurkish that the plan was finished. I told them why. The next day, Davoust was gone.
She took a deep breath.
And so there was no going back. We were ready to move shortly after you arrived. All was arranged. And then...
She paused.
Then? Then you began to strengthen the defenses, and Worms got greedy. He felt that our position was suddenly improved. He demanded more. He threatened to tell you of my plans. I had to go back to the Gurkish to get more. It all took time. Finally, we were ready to move again, but by then it was too late. The chance had passed.
She looked up.
All greed. But for my husband's greed, we would never have come to Degoska. But for the Spicer's greed, we might have succeeded here. But for Worm's greed, we might have given it away and not a drop of blood spilled over this worthless rock. She sniffed and looked back at the floor, her voice growing faint. But greed is everywhere.
So you agreed to surrender the city. You agreed to betray us.
Betray who? There would have been no losers. The merchants could have stepped away quietly. The natives would have been no worse off under Gurkish tyranny than they had been under ours. The Union would have lost nothing but a fraction of its pride. And what is that worth besides the lives of thousands?
Ida stretched forward across the table, her voice growing rough, her eyes wide and shining wet with tears.
Now what will happen? Tell me that. It will be a massacre, a slaughter. Even if you can hold the city, what will be the price? And you cannot hold it. The Emperor has sworn and will not be denied. The lives of every man, woman, and child in Degoska are forfeit. For what? So that Archlector Salt and his like can point at a map and say this dot or that is ours? How much death will satisfy him? What were my reasons? What are yours? Why do you do this? Why?
Glockta's left eye was twitching, and he pressed his hand against it. He stared at the woman opposite through the other. A tear ran down her pale cheek and dripped onto the table.
Why do I do this?
He shrugged. What else is there? Severard reached down and slid the paper of confession across the table.
Sign!
He barked.
Sign!
Hissed Vitari.
Sign, bitch!
Carlotte Danida's hand was trembling as she reached for the pen. It rattled against the inside of the inkwell, dripped black spots on the tabletop, scratched against the paper. There was no flush of triumph.
There never is. But we have one more matter to discuss.
Where will I find the Gurkish agent?
Glockter's voice was sharp as a cleaver.
I don't know. I never knew. Whoever it is will come for you now, as they did for Davoust. Perhaps tonight.
Why have they waited so long?
I told them you were no threat. I told them that Salt would only send someone else. I told them I could handle you.
And so you would have, I do not doubt, were it not for the unexpected generosity of Masters Valent and Bulk.
Glockter leaned forward.
Who is the Gurkish agent?
Ida's bottom lip was quivering so badly that her teeth were nearly rattling in her head.
I don't know, she whispered.
Vitari smashed her hand down on the table.
Who? Who? Who is it, bitch? Who?
I don't know.
Liar!
The practical's chain rattled over Ida's head and snapped taut around her throat. The one-time queen of merchants was hauled over the back of her chair, legs kicking at the air, hands fumbling at the chain round her neck, and flung face down onto the floor.
Liar!
The bridge of Vitari's nose was screwed up with rage, red brows drawn in with effort, eyes narrowed to furious slits. Her boot ground into the back of Ida's head, her back arched, the chain cut white into her clenched fists. Severard looked down on this brutal scene with a slight smile around his eyes, tuneless whistling vaguely audible over the choking, hissing, gurgling of Ida's last breaths. Glockter licked at his empty gums as he watched her thrashing on the cell floor.
She has to die. There are no options. His Eminence demands harsh punishment. His Eminence demands examples made. His Eminence demands scant mercy.
Glockter's eyelid flickered, his face twitched. The room was airless, hot as a forge. He was damp with sweat, thirsty as hell. He could scarcely draw a breath. He felt almost as if he was the one being strangled.
And the irony is that she is right. My victory is a loss for everyone in Dagoska one way or another. Already the first fruits of my labors are groaning their last in the waste ground before the city gates. There will be no end to the carnage now. Gurkish, Dagoskan, Union, the bodies will pile up until we're all buried under them, and all my doing. It would be better by far if her scheme had succeeded. It would be better by far if I had died in the Emperor's prisons. Better for the Guild of Spicers, better for the people of Dagoska, better for the Gurkish, for Corsten Dan Worms, for Carlotte Dan Ida. Better even for me.
Ida's kicking had almost stopped.
One more thing to scrape into the dark corners. One more thing to nag at me when I'm alone. She has to die. Whatever the rights and wrongs of it, she has to die.
Her next breath was a muffled rattle. The next was a gentle wheeze.
Almost done now. Almost done.
Stop!
Barked Glockter.
What?
Severard looked up sharply.
What?
Vitari seemed not to have noticed. The chain was as tight as ever.
Stop! I said! Why?
She hissed.
Why, indeed?
I give you orders, he barked. Not fucking reasons!
Vitari let go the chain, sneering her disgust, and took her boot off the back of Ida's head. She did not move. Her breathing was shallow, a rustling scarcely audible.
But she is breathing. The Archlector will expect an explanation, and a good one. What will my explanation be, I wonder?
Take her back to the cells, he said, leaning on his cane and getting wearily out of his chair.
We might still find a use for her.
Glockter stood by the window, frowned out into the night, and watched the wrath of God rain down upon Dagoska. The three huge catapults, ranged far out of bowshot beyond the city walls, had been in action now since the afternoon. It took perhaps an hour for each one to be loaded and made ready. He had watched the procedure through his eyeglass. First, the machine would be aligned, the range would be judged. A group of white-robed, bearded engineers would argue with one another, peering through eyeglasses of their own, holding up swinging plumb lines, fiddling with compasses and papers and abacuses, making minute adjustments to the huge bolts that held the catapult in place. Once they were satisfied, the great arm was bent back into position. A team of 20 horses, well-whipped and well-lathered, was required to lift the enormous counterweight, a block of black iron carved in the shape of a frowning Gurkish face. Next, the huge shot, a barrel not much less than a stride across, was painstakingly manoeuvred into the waiting scoop by a system of pulleys and a team of frowning, bellowing, arm-waving labourers. Then men stepped away, hurried back fearfully. A lone slave was sent slowly forward with a long pole, a burning wad at its end. He placed it to the barrel. Flames leapt up, and somewhere a lever was hauled down. The mighty weight fell, the great arm, long as a pine trunk, cut through the air, and the burning ammunition was flung up towards the clouds. They had been flying up and roaring down for hours now, while the sun slowly sank in the west. The sky darkened around them, the hills of the mainland became a black outline in the distance. Glockter watched as one of the barrels soared, searing bright against the black heavens. The path of it, a fizzing line, burned into his eye. It seemed to hang over the city for an age, as high almost as the citadel itself, and then tumbled, crackling from the sky like a meteor, a trail of orange fire blazing behind. It fell to earth in the midst of the lower city. Liquid flames shot upwards, spurted outwards, pounced hungrily upon the tiny silhouettes of the slum huts. A few moments later, the thunderclap of the detonation reached Glockter at his window and made him wince.
Explosive powder. Who could have supposed, when I saw it fizzing on the bench of the Adeptus Chemical, that it might make such an awesome weapon?
He half saw, half imagined tiny figures rushing here or there, trying to pull the injured from the burning wreckage, trying to save what they could from their ruined dwellings, chains of ash-blackened natives grimly passing buckets from hand to hand, struggling vainly to contain the spreading inferno.
Those with the least always lose the most in war.
There were fires all across the lower city now, glowing, shimmering, flickering in the wind off the sea, reflecting orange, yellow, angry red in the black water. Even up here the air smelled heavy, oily and choking from the smoke.
Down there it must be hell itself. My congratulations once more, Superior Glockter.
He turned, aware of someone in the doorway. Shickle, her slight shape black in the lamplight.
I'm all right, he murmured, looking back to the majestic, the lurid, the awful spectacle outside the window. After all, you don't get to see a city burn every day.
But his servant did not leave. She took a step forward into the room.
You should go, Shickle. I'm expecting a visitor of a sort, and it could be trouble.
A visitor, eh? Glockter looked up. Her voice sounded different, deeper, harder. Her face looked different, too, one side in shadow, one side lit in flickering orange from the fires outside the window. A strange expression, teeth half bared, eyes fixed on Glockter, and glittering with a hungry intensity as she padded slowly forward. A fearsome expression, almost. If I was prone to fear... And the wheels clicked into place.
You, he breathed.
Me.
You?
Glockter could not help himself. He let out a burst of involuntary chuckling.
Harker, had you? That idiot stumbled on you by mistake, and I let you go. And I thought I was the hero.
He could not stop laughing.
There's a lesson for you, eh? Never do a good turn.
I don't need lessons from you, cripple.
She took one more step, not three strides away from him now.
Wait!
He held up his hand.
Just tell me one thing.
She paused, one brow raised, questioning.
Just stay there.
What happened to DeVoost?
Schickel smiled, sharp, clean teeth.
He never left the room.
She stroked her stomach gently.
He is here.
Glockter forced himself not to look up as the loop of chain descended slowly from the ceiling.
And now you can join him.
She got half a step forward before the chain hooked her under the chin and jerked up, dragging her off her feet into the air, hissing and spitting, kicking and thrashing. Severard sprang up from his hiding place beneath a table, tried to grab hold of Schickel's flailing legs. He yelped as her bare foot cracked into his face, sent him sprawling across the carpet.
Shit!
Gasped Vitari as Schickel wedged her hand under the chain and began to drag her down from the rafters.
Shit!
They crashed onto the floor together, struggled for a moment, then Vitari flew through the air, a flailing black shadow in the darkness. She wailed as she crashed into a table in the far corner of the room, flopped senseless on the floor. Severard was still groaning, rolling slowly onto his back in a daze, hands clasped to his mask. Glockter and Schickel were left staring at one another.
Me and my eater. This is unfortunate.
He backed against the wall as the girl sprang at him, but she only got a step before Frost barreled into her at full tilt, crashed on top of her onto the carpet. They lay there for a moment, then she slowly rolled onto her knees, slowly fought her way up to standing, all of the hulking practical's great weight bearing down on her, slowly took a shuffling step towards Glockter. The albino's arms were wrapped tight round her, straining with every sinew to drag her away, but she kept moving slowly forward, teeth gritted, one thin arm pinned to her thin body, while her free hand clawed out furiously towards Glockter's neck. Hissed Frost, the muscles in his heavy forearms bulging, his white face screwed up with effort, his pink eyes starting from his head. Still, it was not enough. Glockter was pressed back against the wall, watching fascinated as the hand came closer and closer still, just inches from his throat.
This is very unfortunate.
Fuck you!
Screamed Severard. His stick whistled down and cracked into the grasping arm, breaking it clean in half. Glockter could see the bones poking through the ripped and bloody skin, and yet the fingers still twitched, reaching for him. The stick cracked into her face, and her head snapped back. Blood sprayed out of her nose, her cheek was cut right open. Still she came on. Frost was gasping with the effort of keeping her other arm pinned as she strained forwards, mouth snarling, teeth bared, ready to bite Glockter's throat out. Severard threw down his stick and grabbed her round the neck, dragging her head backwards, grunting with the effort, veins pulsing on his forehead. It was a bizarre sight. Two men, one of them big and strong as a bull, trying desperately to wrestle a slip of a girl to the ground. Slowly, the two practicals began to drag her back. Severard had one of her feet off the floor. Frost gave a great bellow, lifted her, and with one last effort, flung her against the wall. She scrabbled at the floor, clawing her way up, broken arm flopping. Vitari growled from the shadows, one of Superior de Voost's heavy chairs raised high in the air. It burst apart over Schickel's head with an almighty crash, and then the three practicals were on her like hounds on a fox, kicking, punching, grunting with rage.
"Enough!" snapped Glockter. "We still have questions!"
He shuffled up beside the panting practicals and looked down. Schickel was a broken mess, motionless. A pile of rags, and not even a big one.
Much as when I first found her. How could this girl almost have overcome these three?
Her broken arm was stretched out across the carpet, fingers limp and bloody.
Safe to say, no threat to anyone now.
Then the arm began to move. The bone slid back into the flesh, made a sickening crunching sound as it straightened out. The fingers twitched, jerked, scratched at the floor, began to slide toward Glockter, reaching for his ankle.
"What is she?"
gasped Severard, staring down.
"Get the chains," said Glockter, cautiously stepping back out of the way. "Quickly!"
Frost dragged two pairs of great irons clanking from a sack, grunting with the effort of lifting them. They were made for the most powerful and dangerous of prisoners, bands of black iron, thick as a sapling trunk, heavy as anvils. He squeezed one pair tight shut around her ankles, the other round her wrists, ratchets scraping into place with a reassuring finality. Meanwhile, Vitari had hauled a great length of rattling chain from the sack and was winding it round and round Schickel's limp body, while Severard held her up, dragging it tight, winding it round and round again. Two great padlocks completed the job. They were snapped shut just in time. Schickel suddenly came alive, began thrashing on the floor. She snarled up at Glockter, straining at the chains. Her nose had already snapped back into place. The cut across her face had already closed.
As though she was never hurt at all. So Yulwe spoke the truth.
The chains rattled as she lunged forward with her teeth, and Glockter had to stumble back out of the way.
"It's persistent,"
muttered Vitari, shoving her back against the wall with her boot.
"You'd have to give it that." "Fools!"
hissed Schickel.
"You cannot resist what comes. God's right hand is falling upon the city, and nothing can save it. All your deaths are already written."
A particularly bright detonation flared across the sky, casting orange light onto the practical's masked faces. A moment later, the thunder of it echoed around the room. Schickel began to laugh, a crazy, grating cackle.
"The hundred words are coming! No chains can bind them! No gates can keep them out! They are coming!"
"Perhaps," Glockter shrugged. "But they will come too late for you."
"I am dead already. My body is nothing but dust. It belongs to the Prophet. Try as you might, you will learn nothing from me."
Glockter smiled. He could almost feel the warmth of the flames far below on his face.
"That sounds like a challenge."
Chapter 25. One of Them. Ardi smiled at him, and Giselle smiled back. He grinned like an idiot. He could not help it. He was so happy to be back where things made sense. Now they need never be parted. He wanted only to tell her how much he loved her, how much he missed her. He opened his mouth, but she pressed her fingers to his lips, firmly.
"Shh."
She kissed him, gently at first, then harder. "Ah," he said. Her teeth nipped at his lip, playful to begin with. "Ah," he said. They bit harder, and harder still.
"Ow!"
he said. She sucked at his face, her teeth ripping at his skin, scraping on his bones. He tried to scream, but nothing came out. It was dark. His head swam. There was a hideous tugging, an unbearable pulling on his mouth.
"Got it?"
said a voice. The agonizing pressure released.
"How bad is it?"
"Not as bad as it looks."
"It looks very bad."
"Shut up and hold that torch higher.
What's that?
What?
That there, sticking out.
His jaw, fool, what do you think it is?
I think I'm going to be sick. Healing is not one of my remarkable...
Shut your fucking hole and hold the torch up. We'll have to push it back in.
Giselle felt something pressing on his face, hard. There was a cracking sound, and an unbearable lance of pain stabbed through his jaw and into his neck like nothing he had ever felt before. He sagged back.
I'll hold it. You move that.
What, this? Don't pull his teeth out! It fell out by itself! Damn fool Pink!
What's happening? Said Giselle.
But all that came out was a kind of gurgle. His head was throbbing, pulsing, splitting with pain.
He's waking up now.
You stitch, then. I'll hold him.
There was a pressure round his shoulders, across his chest, folding him tight. His arm hurt, hurt terribly. He tried to kick, but his leg was agony. He couldn't move it.
You got him?
Yes, I've got him. Get stitching.
Something stabbed into his face. He had not thought the pain could grow any worse. How wrong he had been.
Get off me!
He bellowed, but all he heard was...
Ugh!
He struggled, tried to wriggle free, but he was folded tight, and it only made his arm hurt more. The pain in his face got worse. His upper lip, his lower lip, his chin, his cheek. He screamed and screamed and screamed, but heard nothing. Only a quiet wheezing. When he thought his head would surely explode, the pain grew suddenly less. Done. The grip was released, and he lay back, floppy as a rag, helpless. Something turned his head.
That's good stitching. That's real good. Wish you'd been around when I got these. Might still have my looks.
What looks, Pink?
Best get started on his arm. Then there's the leg to set and all.
Where did you put that shield? No,
groaned Giselle.
Please!
Nothing but a click in his throat. He could see something now, blurry shapes in the half-light. A face loomed towards him, an ugly face. Bent and broken nose, skin torn and crossed with scars. There was a dark face just behind it, a face with a long, livid line from eyebrow to chin. He closed his eyes. Even the light seemed painful. Good stitching. A hand patted the side of his face.
You're one of us now, boy.
Giselle lay there, his face a mass of agony, and the horror crept slowly through every limb.
One of us.
Before They Are Hanged, Part 2. He is not fit for battle that has never seen his own blood flow, who has not heard his teeth crunch under the blow of an opponent, or felt the full weight of his adversary upon him. Roger of Howden. Chapter 26. Heading north. So the dog man was just lying there on his face, wet to the skin and trying to keep still without freezing solid, looking out across the valley from the trees and watching Bethod's army marching. He couldn't see that much of them from where he was lying, just a stretch of the track over a ridge. enough to see the carles tramping by, painted shields bright on their backs, mail glistening with specks of melted snow, spears sticking up high between the tree trunks. Rank after rank of them marching steady. They were a good way off, but he was taking quite a risk even getting this close. Bethod was just as careful as ever. He'd got men out all around, up on the ridges and the high points, anywhere where he thought someone could get a sight of what he was up to. He'd sent a few scouts south, and some others east, hoping to trick anyone was watching, but he hadn't got the dogman fooled. Not this time. Bethod was heading back the way he'd come. He was heading north. Dogman breathed in sharp and gave a long, sad sigh. By the dead, he felt tired. He watched the tiny figures filing past through the pine branches. He'd spent all those years scouting for Bethod, keeping an eye on armies like this one for him, helping him win battles, helping to make him a king, though he'd never dreamed it at the time. In some ways, everything had changed. In others, it was just the same as ever. Here he was, still, face down in the muck, with a sore neck from looking up. 10 years older, and not a day better off. He could hardly remember what his ambitions used to be. But this hadn't been ever among them, he was sure of that. All that wind blown past, all that snow fallen, all that water flowed by, all that fighting, all that marching, all that waste. Logan gone, and Fawley gone, and the candle burning down fast on the rest of them. Grim slithered through the frozen scrub beside him, propped himself on his elbows, and peered out towards the carles moving on the road. He grunted.
Bethod's moving north, whispered Dogman.
Grim nodded.
He's got scouts out all over, but he's heading north, no doubt. We best let Three Trees know.
Another nod. Dogman lay there in the wet.
I'm getting tired.
Grim looked up, lifted an eyebrow.
All this effort. And for what? Everything the same as ever. Whose side is it we're on now?
Dogman waved his hand over at the men slogging down the road.
We supposed to fight all this lot? When do we get a rest?
Grim shrugged his shoulders, squeezed his lips together like he was thinking about it.
When we're dead? And wasn't that the sorry truth?
Took Dogman a while to find the others. They were nowhere near where they should have been by now. Being honest, they weren't far from where they were when he left. Dow was the first one he saw, sat on a big stone, with the usual scowl on his face, glaring down into a gully. Dogman came up next to him, saw what he was looking at. The four southerners, clambering over the rocks, slow and clumsy as newborn calves. Tull and Three Trees were waiting for them at the bottom, looking mighty short on patience.
Bethod's heading north, said Dogman. Good for him.
Not surprised?
Dow licked his teeth and spat.
He's beat every clan that dared face him, made himself a king where there wasn't one before, gone to war with the Union, and he's given him a kicking. He's turned the world on its head, the bastard. Nothing he does surprises me now.
Dogman reckoned he was right enough there.
You lot ain't got far.
No, we ain't. This is some right fucking baggage you've saddled us with here, and no mistake.
He watched the four of them fumbling their way down the gully below, shaking his head like he'd never seen such a waste of flesh.
Some right fucking baggage.
If you're telling me to feel shamed 'cause I saved some lives that day, I don't.
What should I have done? Asked Dogman. Left them to die?
That's one idea. We'd be moving twice the speed without them, and eating a deal better and all.
He flashed a nasty grin.
There's only one that I could find a use for.
Dogman didn't have to ask which one. The girl was at the back. He could hardly see a woman's shape to her, all wrapped up as she was against the cold, but he could guess it was under there, and it made him nervous. Strange thing, having a woman along. Quite the sorry rarity since they went north over the mountains all them months ago. Even seeing one seemed like some kind of a guilty treat. Dogman watched her clambering on the rocks, dirty face half turned towards them. Tough-looking girl, he thought. Seemed like she'd had her share of knocks.
"I reckon she'd struggle,"
Dow muttered to himself.
"I reckon she'd kick some."
"All right, Dow," snapped Dogman. "Let's calm yourself down, lover. You know how Three Trees feels about all that. You know what happened to his daughter? He'd cut your fucking fruits off if he heard you talking that way."
"What?" Dow said, all innocence. "I'm just talking, aren't I? You can't hardly blame me for that. When's the last time any one of us had a woman?"
Dogman frowned. He knew exactly when it was for him. Pretty much the last time he was ever warm. Curled up with Shari in front of the fire, smile on his face wide as the sea. Just before Bethod chucked him and Logan and all the rest of them in chains, then kicked them out into exile. He could still remember that last sight of her, mouth open wide with shock and fright as they dragged him from the blankets, naked and half asleep, squawking like a rooster that knows it's about to get its neck twisted. It had hurt to be dragged away from her. Not as bad as Scale kicking him in the fruits had hurt, mind you. A painful night, all in all, one he'd never thought to live through. The sting from the kicks had faded with time, but the ache of losing her never had done, quite. Dogman remembered the smell of her hair, the sound of her laugh, the feel of her back, pressed warm and soft against his belly while she slept. Well-used memories, picked over and worn thin like a favourite shirt. He remembered it like it was last night. He had to make himself stop thinking about it.
"Don't know that my memory goes back that far," he grunted.
"Nor mine," said Dow. "Ain't you getting tired of fucking your hand?"
He peered back down the slope and smacked his lips. Had a light in his eyes that Dogman didn't much like the look of.
"Funny how you don't miss it so bad until you see it right in front of you. It's like holding out the meat to a hungry man so close he can smell it. Don't tell me you ain't thinking the same thing."
Dogman frowned at him.
"I don't reckon I'm thinking quite the same as you are. Stick your cock in the snow if you have to. That should keep you cooled off."
Dow grinned.
"I'll have to stick it in something soon, I can tell you that."
"Ah!"
came a wail from down the slope. Dogman started for his bow, staring to see if some of Bethod's scouts had caught them out. It was just the prince, slipped and fallen on his arse. Dow watched him rolling on his back, face all squashed up with scorn.
"He's some new kind of useless, that one, eh? All he does is slow us down to half the rate we need, whine louder than a hog giving birth, eat more than his share and shit five times a day."
West was helping him up, trying to brush some of the dirt off his coat. Well, not his coat, the coat that West had given him. Dogman still couldn't see why a clever man would do a damn fool thing like that. Not as cold as it was getting now, middle of winter and all.
"Why the hell would anyone follow that arsehole?"
asked Dow, shaking his head.
"They say his father's the king of the Union itself. What does it matter whose son you are if you ain't worth no more than a turd? I wouldn't piss on him if he was burning, the bastard."
Dogman had to nod. Neither would he. They were all sat in a circle round where the fire would have been if Three Trees had let them have one. He wouldn't, of course, for all the southerners pleading. He wouldn't, no matter how cold it got. Not with Bethod's scouts about. It would have been good as shouting they were there at the tops of their voices. Dogman and the rest were on one side, Three Trees, Dow and Tull, Grim propped on his elbow like none of this had aught to do with him. The Union were opposite. Pike and the girl were putting a brave enough face on being cold, tired and hungry. There was something to them, told the Dogman they were used to it. West looked like he was near the end of his rope, blowing into his cupped hands like they were about to turn black and fall off. Dogman reckoned he should have kept his coat on, rather than give it to the last of the band. The prince was sitting in the midst, holding his chin high, trying to look like he wasn't knackered, covered in dirt, and starting to smell as bad as the rest of them. Trying to look like he might be able to give orders that someone might listen to. Dogman reckoned he'd made a mistake there. A crew like his chose leaders because of what they'd done, not whose son they were. They chose leaders with some bones to them, and from that point of view, they'd sooner have taken a telling from the girl than from this prick.
"It is high time that we discussed our plans," he was whining. "Some of us are laboring in the dark."
Dogman could see three trees starting to frown already. He didn't like having to drag this idiot along, let alone pretend he cared a shit for his opinion. It didn't help much that not everyone could make sense of everyone else. Of the Union, only West spoke Northern. Of the Northmen, only Dogman and Three Trees spoke Union. Tull might have caught the sense of what was being said, more or less. Dal weren't even catching that. As for Grimm, well, silence means pretty much the same in every tongue.
"What's he saying now?" growled Dal.
"Something about plans, I reckon," said Tull back to him.
Dal snorted.
"All an arsehole knows about is shit."
Dogman saw West swallowing. He knew what was being said well enough, and he could tell some folk were running short on patience. The prince wasn't near so clever, though.
"It would be useful to know how many days you think it will take us to get to Ostenholm."
"We're not going south,"
said Three Trees in Northern, before His Highness even finished talking. West stopped blowing into his hands for a moment.
"We're not?" "We haven't been since we set out."
"Why?"
"Because Bethod's heading back north."
"That's a fact," said Dogman. "I seen him today."
"Why would he turn back?"
asked West.
"With Ostenholm undefended."
Dogman sighed.
"I didn't stick around to ask. Me and Bethod ain't on the best of terms."
"I'll tell you why," sneered Dal. "Bethod ain't interested in your city. Not yet, anyhow."
"He's interested in breaking you up into pieces small enough to chew on," said Tull.
Dogman nodded.
"Like that one you was with, that he just finished spitting out the bones of."
"Excuse me,"
snapped the prince, no idea what was being said.
"But it might help if we continued in the common tongue."
Three Trees ignored him and carried on in Northern.
"He's going to pull your army into little bits. Then he's going to squash 'em one by one. You think he's going south, so he hopes your Marshal Burr will send some men south. He'll catch 'em napping on his way back north, and if they're few enough, he'll cut 'em to pieces like he did those others. Then," rumbled Tull, "when all your pretty soldiers are stuck back in the mud or run back across the water,
he'll crack the towns open like nuts in winter, no rush, and his carles will make free with the contents."
Dow sucked his teeth, staring across at the girl. Staring like a mean dog might stare at a side of bacon. She stared right back, which was much to her credit, the Dogman thought. He doubted he'd have had the bones to do the same in her position.
"Bethod's going north, and we'll be following."
Three Trees said it in a way that made it clear it weren't a matter for discussion.
"Keep an eye on him. Hope to move fast and keep ahead, so that if your friend Burr comes blundering through these woods, we can warn him where Bethod's at before he stumbles on him like a blind man falling down a fucking well."
The prince slapped angry at the ground.
"I demand to know what is being said."
"That Bethod is heading north with his army,"
hissed West at him through gritted teeth,
"and that they intend to follow him."
"This is intolerable,"
snapped the fool, tugging at his filthy cuffs.
"That course of action puts us all in danger. Please inform them that we will be setting out southwards without delay."
"That's settled then."
They all turned to see who spoke and got quite the shock. Grimm, talking Union as smooth and even as the prince himself.
"You're going south, we're going north. I need to piss."
And he got up and wandered off into the dark. Dogman stared after him, mouth open. Why did he need to learn someone else's language when he never spoke more than two words together in his own?
"Very well,"
squawked the prince, shrill and panicky.
"I should have expected no better."
"Your Highness,"
hissed West at him.
"We need them. We won't make it to Ostenholm or anywhere else without their help."
The girl's eyes slid sideways. Do you even know which way south is? Dogman stifled a chuckle, but the prince weren't laughing.
We should head south, he snarled, dirty face twitching with anger.
Three Trees snorted.
The baggage don't get a vote, boy, even supposing this was a voting band, which it ain't.
He was finally speaking union, but Dogman didn't reckon the prince would be too happy to know what was being said.
You had your chance to give the orders, and look where it's got you. Not to mention those were fools enough to do what you told them. You'll not be adding any of our names to their list, I can tell you that. If you want to follow us, you'd best learn to keep up. If you want to give the orders, well...
South is that way, said the Dogman, jerking his thumb into the woods. Good luck. Chapter 27 Scant Mercy. To Archlector Salt, head of His Majesty's Inquisition. Your Eminence, the siege of Dagoska continues. 3 days in a row the Gurkish have made assaults against our walls, each one greater in size and determination. They strive to fill in our channel with boulders, to cross it with bridges, to scale our walls and bring rams against our gates. 3 times they have attacked, and 3 times we have thrown them back. Their losses have been heavy, but losses they can well afford. The Emperor's soldiers crawl like ants across the peninsula. Still, our men are bold, our defenses are strong, our resolve is unshakable, and Union vessels still ply the bay, keeping us well supplied. Be assured, Dagoska will not fall. On a subject of lesser importance, you will no doubt be pleased to learn that the issue of Magister Ida has been put to rest. I had suspended her sentence while I considered the possibility of using her connection with the Gurkish against them. Unfortunately for her, the chances of such subtle measures bearing fruit have dropped away, leaving us with no further use for her. The sight of a woman's head decorating the battlements might have been detrimental to the morale of our troops. We, after all, are the civilized faction. The one-time magister of the Guild of Spices has therefore been dealt with quietly, but, I can assure you, quite finally. Neither one of us need spare her or her failed conspiracy any further thought. As always, Your Eminence, I serve and obey. Sandan Glokta, Superior of Dagoska. It was quiet down by the water, quiet and dark and still. The gentle waves slapped at the supports of the wharf, the timbers of the boats creaked softly, a cool breeze washed in off the bay, the dark sea glittered in the moonlight under a sky dusted with stars. You could never guess that a few short hours ago men were dying in their hundreds less than half a mile away, that the air was split with screams of pain and fury, that even now the ruins of 2 great siege towers are still smouldering beyond the land walls, corpses scattered round them like leaves fallen in autumn. Glockter felt his neck click as he turned and squinted into the darkness. Practical frost emerged from the shadows between 2 dark buildings, peering suspiciously around, herding a prisoner in front of him. Someone much smaller, hunched over and wrapped in a cloak with the hood up, arms secured behind them. The 2 figures crossed the dusty quay and came down the wharf, their footfalls clapping hollow on the wooden planks. All right, Frothed, said Glockter as the albino pulled his prisoner up. I don't think we need that any more. The white fist pulled back the cowl. In the pale moonlight, Carlot Dan Ida's face looked gaunt and wasted, full of sharp edges, with a set of black grazes across her hollow cheek. Her head had been shaved, after the fashion of confessed traitors, and without that weight of hair her skull seemed strangely small, almost childlike, her neck absurdly long and fragile. Especially with a ring of angry bruises round it, the dark after-images left by the links of Vitari's chain. There was hardly any remnant of the sleek and masterful woman who had taken him by the hand in the Lord Governor's audience chamber, it seemed an age ago. A few weeks in the darkness, sleeping on the rotten floor of a sweltering cell, not knowing if you'll live another hour. That can ruin the looks. I should know.
She lifted her chin at him, nostrils wide, eyes gleaming in black shadows.
That mixture of fear and defiance that comes on some people when they know they are about to die.
Superior Gokta, I hardly dared hope I would see you again.
Her words might have been jaunty, but there was no disguising the edge of fear in her voice.
What now? A rock tied round the legs and into the bay? Isn't that all a touch dramatic?
It would be, but that isn't what I have in mind.
He looked up at Frost and gave the barest of nods. Ida flinched, squeezing her eyes shut and biting on her lip, hunching her shoulders as she felt the hulking practical loom up behind her.
Waiting for the crushing blow on the back of the skull, the stabbing point between the shoulder blades, the choking wire across the throat, the terrible anticipation. Which shall it be?
Frost raised his hand. There was a flash of metal in the darkness, then a gentle clicking as the key slid smoothly into Ida's manacles and unlocked them. She slowly prized open her eyes, slowly brought her hands round in front of her, blinked down as though she'd never seen them before.
What's this?
This is exactly what it appears to be.
He nodded his head down the wharf.
This is a ship leaving for Westport on the next tide. You have contacts in Westport?
The tendons in her thin neck fluttered as she swallowed.
I have contacts everywhere.
Good. Then this is me setting you free.
There was a long silence.
Free?
She lifted one hand to her head and rubbed absently at her stubbly scalp, staring at Glockter for a drawn-out moment.
Not sure whether to believe it, and who can blame her? I'm not sure that I believe it.
His eminence must have mellowed beyond recognition.
Glockter snorted.
Not likely. Thult knows nothing about this. If he did, I rather think we both might be swimming with rocks round our ankles.
Her eyes narrowed.
The merchant queen judges the bargain.
Then what's the price?
The price is you're dead. You're forgotten. Put Dagothka from your mind. It's finished. Find some other people to save. The price is you leave the Union and never come back. Not ever.
That's it?
That's it.
Why?
Ah, my favorite question. Why do I do this?
He shrugged.
What does it matter? A woman lost in the desert should take such water as she is offered, no matter who it comes from. Don't worry. I won't be saying no.
She reached out suddenly, and Glockter half-jerked away, but her fingertips only touched him gently on his cheek. They rested there for a moment, while his skin tingled, and his eye twitched, and his neck ached.
Perhaps, she whispered, if things had been different.
If I weren't a cripple and you weren't a traitor. Things are as they are.
She let her hand drop, half-smiling.
Of course they are.
I would say I'll see you again.
I'd rather you didn't.
She nodded slowly.
Then, goodbye.
She pulled the hood over her head, throwing her face back into shadow, then brushed past Glockter and walked quickly towards the end of the wharf. He stood, weight on his cane, and watched her go, scratching his cheek slowly where her fingers had rested.
So, to get a woman to touch you, you need only spare their lives. I should try it more often.
He turned away, limped a few painful steps onto the dusty quay, peering up into the dark buildings.
I wonder if practical Vitari is in there somewhere watching. I wonder if this little episode will find its way into her next report to the Archlector.
He felt a sweaty shiver up his aching back.
I won't be putting it in mine, that's sure. But what does it really matter?
He could smell it as the wind shifted, the smell that seemed to find its way into every corner of the city now, the sharp smell of burning, of smoke, of ash, of death. Without a miracle, none of us will leave this place alive.